and council members. So go ahead and hit it. It's got to be 5:30 within seconds here. So I will say, welcome to the Planning and Community Development Committee meeting for Monday, September 20th, 2021. Welcome staff and my fellow council members, Verna Seal and Tom McLeod. And the first item on our agenda is our two applications for lodging tax funds for the city of Tukwila, two different events, and Brandon's going to tell us about those.
Yes, thank you, Councilor Member. For the record, Brandon Miles, Economic Development for the city of Tukwila. So there are two funding requests that are before the committee tonight. As a reminder, we collect lodging tax funds from eligible hotel stays in the city of Tukwila. Under state law, those funds can only be used for tourism promotion activity. I say this for the benefit of anyone who might be watching that we don't later on. These are not general fund dollars. They cannot be used for general fund activities. So we have two requests, both from the city of Tukwila. One is to sponsor the Gut Check Wrestling Tournament down in the city of Kent at the Showwear Event Center. This is was forwarded to us, this opportunity from the city of Kent staff. Unfortunately, they have a freezing effect that they can't sponsor activities. And so they asked if we would be able to support this wrestling tournament. This wrestling tournament is a three-day tournament at the end of the year. It will bring in several thousand participants from across the country. And so what we've done here is the total request is $15,000 with about 9,000 of that being a rebate. So they have to show that they generated the hotel room nights in our hotels in order to get that rebate. That's we're experimenting with the rebate program as a way to kind of see if we get direct benefit from this activity. And then the additional $6,000 is just a straight sponsorship for branding and marketing purposes. Again, this is a great opportunity for us to see if we can bring some hotel nights into the city in December, which is typically a slow month for our hotels. Before I move on to the next application, are there any questions about this, the Gut Check application?
All right, we'll start with Verna.
Yeah, can you tell me again why, I'm sorry, I was flipping through pages when you said why Kent can't do this?
So for one thing, the city of Kent does not have the type of lodging tax that we do. You know, we generate in a good year before COVID about $800,000 a year. Theirs is a lot lower. The city of Kent has a broad spending freeze in effect for all of their funds. Unfortunately, it impacts their lodging tax as well. So they're not awarding lodging tax applications this year. So they forwarded on to us a number of events. This is one. We have some other ones which are going to now move from Kent to Tukwila. Our goal is to keep it in the region, and so that's why Kent forwarded it to us.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you. Tom, any comments, questions?
Yeah, a couple questions. On this one, I was doing the math on page 9. The people that travel more than 50 miles, and they think there's going to be 1,200 people. And just trying to equate that to $15 and how many rooms. And it wasn't really making sense to me. So do you really think that I like that we're doing a test. And I don't even mind supporting our neighbor Kent to keep the event in the region. I'm all for those things. But do you really think that'll pencil out? I don't know how far Showwear Center is from Tukwila in terms of miles. Who's to say they don't go the other way or into Renton, you know, and get hotels?
So the Showwear Event Center is about 5 miles from the southern edge of the South Center District. I asked some of our hotels if they get much showroom business, and a number of them do say they do. Our hotels right now are better than SeaTac hotels, Kent hotels. You know, we have a higher quality. There's more things to do. I've actually seen a hockey bus that was playing against the Thunderbirds standing at a Tukwila hotel. So we do see some of the people staying in our hotels. The one thing, though, Councilor Member McLeod, people could still book in Renton or Kent or someplace else. In order for them to get the credits, and I actually just got this today, the group has to set up a block of rooms with hotels, and then there's a number or a link that you're given. And so we will be able to track directly the rooms that are attributed to this block. One thing I would comment on is the number of people does not always equal the hotel rooms. You know, 2, 3, or 4 people. If you have a family coming in, you have a family of 4 staying in 1 hotel room. So that's why the numbers don't always jive up and link correctly.
Okay. And my other question would be, so this goes before the LTAC committee, and they approve these things. Is there any of these applications, because I read in here that if they don't approve it, we never see it. Does that ever happen?
So while I have been with the Lodging Tax Advisory Committee staffing it, I can't remember an application that was actually formally voted down by staff, or excuse me, by the LTAC. I think there was one application that we had that staff was proposing years ago that was somewhat, we didn't have the full support of the committee, and so we ended up withdrawing it and not moving it forward at that time. But, we do have an informal policy that if the LTAC ever votes and says we don't want to fund something, we are going to inform the council, whether that just be is an email or we bring it up under we come into this committee and we check in. We would let the council know that an application had been denied, just for transparency purposes. The council cannot override that decision, but there's no reason why you can't know about it. There's minutes kept. It's a public meeting, just like your meetings are.
Okay. I'll be very curious how this goes, and I look forward to you'll report back to us.
Yep. Our plan is to always report back on every application.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes, and I want to add something to that, just to remind us that a council member always chairs LTAC and is the chair, and so they can always report back during reports about a meeting if something was declined. So there's several places that could happen. I do. I have a couple of comments. One is, I think this is great that you're doing the block rooms and having rebating instead of just sort of guessing. It's, you know, we've got data from it, and I loved this for this one and also the next event. And I just have one thing that I'm curious about. It mentioned something about an official event hotel. Is there going to be, did anyone express interest, or is it too early?
So I actually, on the Gut Check Wrestling Tournament, I just found out that the Courtyard by Marriott on West Valley Highway and the Embassy Suites on West Valley Highway have both stepped up and will be the official hotels for this event. So I just looked at the link that was created, and so when the coaches throughout the country get their packet, they'll be given this link that they then can go and book their hotel rooms on. I've expressed I've reminded the event organizers, you've got to push that block, because if people go through Expedia, even if they book in Tukwila, it's not going to be reflected in your numbers. So.
Right. Okay, so any other questions before we go on to the second request? All right, thank you, Brandon. And so we now have the rugby.
So, over the last 3 or 4 years with the Seattle Seawolves playing in Tukwila, we've really built a market in rugby. We've seen this with the Seattle Seawolves. We had 2 international matches that were in Tukwila in 2019. We also, in August, we had the Rugby Sevens that was here. So another opportunity has presented itself. It's called the X5 Series. It is a amateur. It's a very advanced amateur league. So this is like one step below pros, but they're amateur players who will travel throughout the country and have games. Starfire Sports will be used as the home training facility for the Seattle rugby team when they play their games. And so, similar to the earlier application, this is a $15,000 total request. $10,000 is a straight sponsorship to the X5 series, and $5,000 is a sponsorship that we would do with Seattle Rugby to get as a room rebate. You might notice the numbers between these 2 applications is similar, but the rebate's reduced a little bit. I have a lot of confidence that any event at Starfire Sports is going to put rooms in our hotels just because of the proximity to Starfire to our hotels. So again, this is another great opportunity for us to build our rugby brand and to put hotel room nights in our hotels in the middle of the ongoing pandemic and to support our overnight economy. So happy to answer any questions related to this application.
Tom?
No, I did not have any questions, and I am supportive of it. Good work.
Thank you.
No, I don't have any questions. I mean, I think it's good. Rugby is, it's getting a lot bigger, and I think we're getting known for rugby. You know, while I don't go to the games, I have worked with rugby players for years on another thing that I do. So, but yeah, I'm fine with this.
Well, Councilor Member, just a fun thing. One of the reasons the X5 series is existing, and I hope not to take any work away from you, but some of the games between the Seattle Seawolves and their competitors, there's only two or three Americans on the pitch.
Yeah,
and
that's
so
true.
What they're trying to do with the X5 series is just like a lot of other professional development, is they want to develop rugby in the United States. And they want to be able to have more Americans out on the field, be able to send more Americans overseas, and to be able to have Americans compete at a higher level for international play. So that's kind of the goal here. I had not realized the large number of South Africans and Europeans and Australians that are playing in these leagues. So.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Sareve had a vision, and I think it's coming true. So he was behind the seven. So, yeah, I'm good.
All right, thank you. I have no questions. Do we have consensus to send this to the consent agenda at our next regular meeting? All right. Thank you, Brandon.
Thank you.
All right. Next item on the agenda is code enforcement procedures and policies. This is for information only, and the issue is current enforcement procedures, how cases are prioritized. So Nora or Kia, whoever's going to start this off, go ahead.
Yeah, so Nora Gerloff with Community Development, and this is kind of a follow-up discussion here with the council to talk a little bit more about, you know, what is the procedure that we go through and how do we kind of step through the different layers of code enforcement. You know, we try and of course have sort of work with the owners or the complainants and use the appropriate levels, you know, as we move forward. And then also talking about, you know, how do we prioritize? There's obviously more issues out there than we can address with the staff that we have. So we have to make some choices and just kind of showing you how we walk through those things. So Kia's gonna give you her on the ground vision of how this works, and then we'll be happy to answer your questions.
Hi, good evening, Council Committee. For the record, I'm Kia Shagana with Code Enforcement. I'm a Code Enforcement Officer. Okay, so just a quick overview of our process. We do have standard procedures that are documented. That is part of Attachment A in the agenda packet. So we get complaints in a number of different ways. People can call us, they can come in, they can email us, and we have also restarted the Tequila Works complaint as well. I think that's a form that's a little different than it was, but it's another opportunity for people to reach out to city staff. And so when we get a complaint, the first thing we do is we review it, we assess it, and determine, you know, if it is a violation or a potential violation, then we go ahead and open up a case, and we start typically with a courtesy letter. A courtesy letter would typically be appropriate for issues that are less severe, so you know, minor to moderate severity, and typically also with properties that haven't had issues or the same issue within the last 2 years. So we always usually want to start with a friendly educational approach, just to let people know that, just so you know, we got a complaint, this is what the issue was, just so you know, this is against our code. If it's a problem, please correct it. you know, if it's not, if this isn't an issue on your property, thanks for being a good neighbor. Please reach out to us with any questions that you have. So that's how we would usually start the process. From there, we would do a site visit and determine, is there actually a problem here? If we go out there and there's not, then the case gets closed. If we go out there and there is a problem, then we take photos and we would move on to our next step, which would typically be a request for compliance. A request for compliance is a more formal notice that actually documents that, yes, in fact, there is a violation. Here is what the officer observed. This is the code reference, and this is what you need to do to correct the issue. So in circumstances where the violation is a bit more severe, we do always have the ability to skip both the courtesy letter and the request for compliance and go straight to a notice of violation and order. So that is, again, a much more official, firm notice that it's an administrative order that basically says you are in violation, you must fix this, this is your deadline. If you don't fix it by said date, then you will be assessed a monetary penalty of $250 a day per day per violation. We typically will reserve that notice for, again, the most severe issues or after we have exhausted our more friendly educational approaches first. So after a notice of violation and order, if it still hasn't been corrected at that point after the compliance deadline, then we would go and we would issue a notice of assessment. That's where we actually assess the penalties of the $250 a day per violation. And we typically would issue that within 30 days of their compliance deadline. We try not to have it be too long because it can be quite shocking when people get those large numbers. So we want to get it to them sooner rather than later. So from there, standard process will typically issue a total of two notice of assessments. Now, the officer, code enforcement officers do have some discretion to mitigate those fees. You know, things that we look at are, you know, did the party correct the issues? Was the responsible party willful or knowing of the violation? Was the responsible party responsive to correcting it? So there's certain criteria that we can look at and determine if it's appropriate to mitigate those fees, because ultimately we're not trying to get their money, we're trying to get them to fix the problem. So if after we've made those assessments, if they still don't fix the problem, then that's where we would have to look at our abatement process and determine if this is something that is appropriate to move forward through a litigation process. If it is not, so in some circumstances, we determine that it's not appropriate to take it to court, then we may just file a tax lien, record all of, you know, the notice of violation and order and record those against the property, and then the case would get closed as unresolved. However, those issues would come up when the property either tried to refinance or sell, and that would typically trigger them to be like, okay, and then they would get that resolved at that point. So that's a brief overview of what our process looks like, and now I just want to give you kind of an overview of how we determine priorities. So typically we have to look at every case as unique and individual because there's so many variations. But typically we would look at, is there a high risk of imminent hazard to public health, environmental health or safety? And so some of the issues that would fall into that would include sensitive area violations. So that in and of itself has a variety. So it could include issues with the shoreline, streams, wetlands, buffers, steep slopes. You know, some examples could include removal of trees on steep slopes, illegal fill within a wetland, garbage dumped on the shoreline. Those would be some examples. Another example would be hazardous structure violations. So again, that could be a variety of things, including, you know, electrical hazards created by improperly installed electrical components, unpermitted construction, unsecured vacant structure, and unsound accessory structures. So those are just some examples. Typically, under most circumstances, some of the violations that we typically look at as being lower risk of imminent hazard would include parking, overgrowth, and storage of junk vehicles. Now, overgrowth, that would be except in extreme circumstances. You know, sometimes you do have an extreme circumstance where either overgrowth is 6 feet tall and it's a fire hazard. So that would be treated a little bit differently than someone's grass is just a bit overgrown and they've got some weeds. So typically when we're looking, you know, we're assessing where does this fall, how big of a threat is this to imminent, you know, to immediate safety and the environmental health. And so we look at all of those different things in deciding, you know, kind of how we prioritize those cases. Any questions for me?
Verna, do you have any questions?
Not in the, like the overall, I understand the whole process. I guess one thing that has always been a question to me as a council member over the years is people see things and things have been there forever. And I know it takes a long time for the abatement process. I mean, it would be nice, I think, at some point for maybe the council, maybe in this committee or maybe the general overall council to get like an update on certain properties that we know have been a challenge over the years. I can think of one down 42nd, the house that had the add-on, the addition adding on for as long as I've lived here.
So just a heads up is I did send an email out to Laurel today that actually does provide an update for some of our oldest, most notable cases. So when you have an opportunity to review that, if there are still other specific properties that you have questions on, please definitely feel free to let us know what properties those are, and I'd be happy to provide an update on those.
Perfect. That's all I need to know. Other than that, this is really helpful. I love this. This is a great, can't even see it, the diagram, the kind of flow chart. This is really good. And I've been on, you know, I've been on our website and looked at our code enforcement section, and I like it because it has stuff like on, you know, because I send people there all the time. So this is great. So thank you.
Yes, absolutely.
Thanks for all you do, because I know it's not an easy job.
We do our best.
Mm-hmm. Tom.
I didn't have a specific question. I thought Jim Toole put out an email that we got a copy of today, I think it was today, that really laid out the process kind of in real life, you know, as far as the case he's handling right now. And it was a good email to read and to see how he step by step went through it. So the timing is good on that. The one question I might have for the department, how do you feel on cases that you're getting from the community? Do you feel you have enough resources to deal with them, or you're just always running behind on it, chasing your tail all the time? That might be a Nora question.
You know, I'd say we do our best, but, you know, I know Councilmember Duffy sometimes was frustrated with us that some of the, you know, weeds and visual appearance things did fall to the bottom of the list sometimes. You know, we have a lot of construction without permits issues that go on. That is a lot of our workload right now, but also an important thing to follow up on. So, and then, you know, the frustrating thing is sometimes, you know, like 20% of the cases can take 60% of your time, you know, where you're just follow up after follow up and you just get an owner who you can't make care about the project. And there are some of those, not everyone responds to the courtesy letter with a, I'm going to go fire up my, you know, lawnmower or whatever it is. That's, so there's challenges. You know, and I think some of the Dirty Dozen long-term cases that we've seen, people can know how to play the legal system, and, you know, we only have so many tools at our disposal. So some of those can drag out for a very long time.
Okay. I don't have any further questions. I appreciate the presentation, just kind of bringing this up, but I, like I said, I thought Jim Toole's email really laid out in real life how this process is working.
You know, I would say having, you know, Google Maps and the his dated photographs that go down the streets are a real help in code enforcement to say it wasn't there in 2017 and it is there in 2019 or something, and you should really pinpoint when things happened.
Yeah, I loved in his email the roof patches in the before and after photos. Yeah, mm-hmm. That was great.
You know, Tom, I don't think I have that email. I don't know what email. That does not sound familiar to me.
Did
that
go? I didn't send it to you. Just me.
Well, never mind.
So that was in response to the Ethiopian Community Center.
Got it. That email. Got it. Okay, you're off the hook now, Tom.
Mm-hmm. All right. Any other questions?
Yeah, I had a couple comments. And Verna, if you don't have that, then. And I think it came in later.
I do. I know what he's talking about now. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry. It's been a long day.
Yeah. So I thank you for this. And I think that on a sort of a semi-regular basis, every couple of years, it's good for us to have this update and report, especially as new council members come on to the council. And so this is good information to have. And I wish I could hold this up and show, oh, I can even see it. The little happy houses with the sun at the end. That was like, awesome.
That's Tia's work, actually. She put that together.
So there's the happy houses. So my question that I'm wondering is, do you ever get to the end of the list? Are there cases that you just never get to?
I wouldn't say that there are cases we never get to, but in terms of getting to the end of the list, I mean, with the casework style, the work is never done. There's always a new case coming in, so there's always a backlog, so to speak. You know, the way that I operate with my caseload is I go through and I want to touch every single one of them. Now, a touch might be, you know, okay, we sent them a notice, their date is passed, but I know they're working on it, so I'm going to follow up with an email that says, you know, hey, just so you know, this case is still open. So for a lot of our properties that have, where all we're waiting for them to finish their permits, right? So they're technically in compliance because they have their permit, but we're not going to close the case because the permit isn't finalized yet. So with those, sometimes those can stay open for a couple of years because their permits stay open for a couple of years. And so what I like to do is follow up with those property owners on a semi-regular basis to touch base and let them know, hey, we do still have this case and it's going to stay open until your permit has received an approved final inspection. So this kind of falls a little outside of our flow chart because they're technically in compliance. There's no need to issue, you know, a formal notice, but I want them to know that they're still on our radar, that there's still work that needs to be done. And so we'll continue to follow up until they actually finalize their permit. At that point, then we can close the case. So all the cases get touched and worked regularly, but there is no end of the list. I mean, there's always new cases coming in. And cases to follow up, if that makes sense.
Yes, thank you. So I'm going to just stop for a minute here and say we've got a lot of people that have gone online and they're not muted. And sometimes it's a little hard if you're on the phone, it's like star six. So I'm just going to press mute all right now. And so then if you're talking, you can just unmute after that. So, or somebody did. Mute everyone. Okay, so everyone's muted. And then so you can unmute yourself. So thank you. And sorry for that slight interruption. My only other question is, I know that we went over this during budget time, but how many staff do we have in the code enforcement department right now? So I don't recall. Nora, that's a question for you.
So we've got Kia in rental housing. We have Jim Toole in general code enforcement. We just recently hired a second code enforcement officer, Joseph Mose. So we're very excited about him. He's in training right now. We have admin support by Lori Solberg, and so she's doing public records requests and support for code enforcement. And then we have like a quarter time of Amy Wardian in the permit center, who's also supporting our code enforcement officers.
Well, thank you for your commitment to that and for the hiring of the new person. I think it's really great, so appreciate that. All right, any other questions from my fellow council members? All right. Thank you, Kia, for your good work, and thank you, Nora.
Thank you.
And we will go on to the next item, which is I got to get to my, flipping my pages here. This is the King County Recreational Vehicle Safe Lot proposal and for the site, and Rachel is going to tell us about this. And it's
Thank you. Good evening. For the record, Rachel Bianchi, Deputy City Administrator. Before I get started on the King County Recreational Vehicle Safe Light proposal, I do want to follow up and tie up one kind of bow on something that we had talked about a couple months ago, which is King County's Health Through Housing program. You'll remember they were talking with Tukwila about whether or not we wanted to be what is commonly known as a willing city. The county has reached out and let us know that they are no longer looking in the city of Tukwila for any health through housing sites. So just wanted to make sure everybody had that information. So King County has recently allocated $500 million in ARPA funds with the intent to serve 500 homeless individuals over the next 2 years. As you all know very well, ARPA funds are have a very short time period, so that we're talking about a two-year time period. These are one-time funds that will not be replenished. So they have a broad response and a number of different things that they're using these funds for, which I attached to the memo some information, not just about how they're looking to spend the ARPA funds, but how they're spending a variety of different funds associated with people experiencing homelessness. One of the things that they've identified is the need for an RV safe lot. Many communities throughout the region have folks living in RVs, sometimes not always in the best conditions or safest for the residents of those RVs. You may remember that the county came to us a few months ago when you had an update on the airport. They let you know that they had purchased the Randy's, former Randy's restaurant site for a fuel tank farm. They still intend to do that. They would like to, however, on a temporary basis for 2 years, host up to 50 RVs for that two-year period. They expect that the peak would be about 20 RVs max. As you can see in the memo, they have already, and again, this is a preliminary proposal, but they have committed to screen fencing around the perimeter, controlled entry, personnel, on-site personnel, which includes 24-hour security, a site manager, behavioral health, and staff focusing on connecting people to permanent housing and employment. Interestingly, because this is not something that has been done in our region, the county is going to be the service provider. They will not be contracting. So, and they've worked really closely with a jurisdiction down in California that's been really successful with these programs to gain their knowledge. The site would also have regular visits from mobile RV tanks, the empty tanks, things like that. This is assuming that they can't, I mean, they are going to see whether or not they could connect to the existing sewer, water, and electricity, but the sewer connection could be a little bit tricky, so they are committed to dealing with the gray water if needed. And then they understand that, you know, mechanics will be needed. They understand, and what I'm trying to convey is, the reality of these vehicles, right? So bring this before you because this does fall under the proposed TMC changes that you all discussed at last week's meeting at Committee of the Whole, and that you'll discuss again more this evening, which is in response to HB 1220. We do believe that this would qualify as a as an emergency shelter, since we have not designated whether or not an emergency shelter should be indoor or outdoor. So under those proposed TMC changes, again, they haven't, they're not existing, right? Because you're still deliberating. This specific proposal would have a capacity limit of up to 45 individuals. The county doesn't think that's going to be an issue. Again, they would peak at 25 RVs. We would develop and monitor a good neighbor agreement that we would create with the county, which would cover things like quiet hours, smoking, security procedures, litter, landscape, screening. All of the residents would need to sign a code of conduct agreement. Any non-RV vehicles would have to be subject to a parking plan. We would have coordination between the site and emergency services, and then we would also require regular communication with the Human Services Program Coordinator on the success of the program. So, again, this is still preliminary. The county's still looking at it. The county would need to get a demolition permit to do this. That would be the one permit that they would need. There may be a couple of other associated, but smaller permits. They would need to adhere to the other issues that's laid out in the TMC changes. And then I think one thing for us all to remember is all applicable codes are still in play, right? So the stormwater section of the code is still in play, right? There are still plenty of other ways for the city to ensure that its long-term goals are adhered to. So really, this is informational only at this point. We've only had a couple of very early discussions with the county on this. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rachel. I'll start with you, Tom. Questions? Okay.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Have we spoken to and got feedback from the neighboring businesses?
So we have not, but the county is committed to doing outreach to the neighboring businesses. So I know that they have had conversations with Boeing. I don't know to the extent of them. I also know that we suggested very strongly that they reach out to the Museum of Flight, which they indicated that the executive office would take care of. But that is part of their process, is to basically go door to door and to do that outreach. The county is intent on being very transparent in this, which is why they came to us early.
Okay. What is the timeline on this project, and do we have some opportunities to weigh in further on it, or when will it come back to committee?
So it would be informational only to come back to committee to provide you information, assuming that the TMC changes that you move forward with, if you move forward with the TMC changes tonight, right? So the good neighbor agreement, the code of conduct, all of those gates, as one would say, regulations that the TMC changes allow, those are administrative in nature and not councilmatic.
So they... So tonight, if that happens, then this is in play, and it's just a matter of then how it happens?
I mean, the county's still looking at, you know, a variety of different options. They are very keen on the Randy site, but I can't say, Councilmember, that yes, this will happen. I think that they are just preliminary looking at things. They do have a very rapid timeline because of the temporary nature of the ARPA funds. So, you know, I mentioned earlier, one of the key things would be a demolition permit and those associated permits. So we'd have to see whether our timelines could match up.
In general, I'm in favor of this. It seems like a good use. I'm concerned about just the site, its appearance, safety with other businesses, you know, some of these other places that they've made for unhoused individuals. They look like hell at times, or when they leave the facility, and how do we prevent that from happening here where people clean up their own room?
And that's part of, that was part of a good neighbor agreement, council member, that's absolutely part of that. And we would develop that in, you know, in concert with the county. And then within it, there would be teeth to hold hold folks responsible for what they signed.
I think it's important that there's teeth to it, and it's just not a free pass to live however they want to live.
So that's the whole point of the TM changes.
Yep.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Tom. Verna.
Yeah. This makes me actually really happy. And when I look at our surrounding jurisdictions and what they are doing to address the issue at hand, I think this is a very preliminarily good thought out use for that Randy's site, as well as a way for us to play a part. There's a whole lot of, you know, things that have to go into this. Like you said, the good neighbor agreement, what's it going to look like? But, you know, so if there's only going to be 20 at a time, that is a smaller number, which is good. So I have a couple questions. I don't need answers tonight, but just as we're talking about it. Well, so when we say recreational vehicle, do we mean RVs or do we also mean like vans? Because some individuals have converted vans. So is it vans, RVs? I think of a recreational vehicle as something that has a toilet. Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe some vans do. I don't know. But that was a question that popped into my head just out there. And then the other thing, too, as far as under the discussion, you know, personnel, 24 on-site security, I'd like to see some provisions made for pets. A lot of people become homeless because wherever they're living, they cannot take their pets. And a lot of people feel, me included, that your pets are part of your family. And a lot of times, especially when, you know, you've got ESA pets, you've got, you know, they play an integral part. So I would want to make sure that there is some provision for pets or some work pets into it, because I would hate to see somebody turned away because they have a pet, because they don't have like a artificial turf place for the play for them to do their business. But I just think it's important to include pets. And other than that, I mean, a lot of this is going to be in the sausage making process. But preliminarily, I think it fits. I think it fits with what we have on our agenda tonight. So, you know, I'm in favor of it, and I hope that we can find a way to make it work. But those are my only comments. Thanks.
Thanks, Verna. And I love your comment about the pets, because as more and more people become renters, this is more and more of an issue on all sides, because some people take really good care of their pets and some don't. So it's just complicated, right? So I'm looking at the, for a regular council meeting, we have the zoning code amendments for the HB 1220 compliance. And so this timing is perfect because we, as the council, have really looked through the this, and the good neighbor agreement is a big part of our compliance process. And I'm looking at it, says quiet hours, smoking areas, so on and so forth. So I have a comment and a question about that. One is, so that good neighbor agreement is not going to come through the council and be approved by the council. That's staff, right? That's administrative. Is there some way that we could have a report on that? I would really.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I'd really like to have council have regular updates on this process if it goes through, and hopefully we're going to be hearing good news and really good reports about this RV. It like my other fellow council members have said, you know, there's a lot of potential here. But now I'm going to throw something in for our regular meeting for my fellow council members to think about. Should the good neighbor agreement address pets? Or are we going, or would that be implied? And Rachel, is that like just really getting out there too far in the weeds? Yes.
I might suggest that you leave that to an administrative decision, because you may have some emergency shelters that it may not work, frankly, to have pets, and you may have some, and I would concur with Councilmember Seal about the importance of pets in one's family, and I'm just glad you can't hear mine this time. But there may be some shelter situations where it actually wouldn't be good for either the community who's there or the community who is surrounding. So my suggestion is leave that administrative, but with the instruction to staff that, you know, the importance of pets when it can work for both community, for all the whole community.
Especially like an RV might be a little more able to do that than say like a shelter where you've got everybody's got a room and a bed.
A congregate shelter could be a little more difficult for that.
But I like that, and I've been thinking about that actually, about how pets for renters, how that can be a challenge. And so my comment is I'd love to hear updates on this on some sort of regular basis. And when it comes to reporting out tonight, I think that we as council members can look at the zoning code, just knowing that this is coming up. And then I will bring it up during reports. If you want to, you can bring it up during the meeting. But I think that it's reflective. The code is good, and so I won't be bringing it up. I'll be bringing it up during reports. So
okay,
great. And what if the council wants to hear more about it, Rachel? How would you like to handle that? Would you like to give a report to COW, or, you know?
I'd be happy to if that's what you'd like. My suggestion is, let me go back to the county and kind of see where they are in the process, right? Yeah. Get a little bit more information. I'm also happy to have asked the county to come and give you more. It doesn't need to just be your staff, right? We could have the county come if you'd like. So, Councilmember Hogarty, how about I'll reach out to the county and then you and I can decide the best way to, as your role in chair, to go to the full council with this?
It's very possible that a fellow council member will ask for it to come to the full council too. So we'll just take it how it works out. So yeah. Okay. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. And so that is our final item on the agenda. Is there any miscellaneous from my fellow council members?
Nope.
Okay, seeing none, I will see you all at 7 o'clock. Thank you so much.
Bye.
Hi, this is Tigis Brohani. Are we done talking about the safety? I'm not hearing anything anymore. Hello? Is the meeting over or what?
TG, I don't know what's going on. I also hear nobody. I just hear you.
Oh, so they... this is confusing.
I know.
Is the union joining? Who's joining from our part?
Guys, let's hang up this call. I mean, let's call back again. Okay, let's see.
Okay.
This is weird. I don't know what's going on. Okay, let me bye.
Yeah. Hi, the meeting is still going, but about the safety concern, because right now, for some reason, I'm not hearing. I don't know if you guys are done or not. I'm not sure. Can somebody tell me something, please? Hi, I was in the meeting, but I'm not hearing anything anymore. Is the meeting over or what? Hello? Hello? Is anybody can hear me? Can someone tell me if the meeting is over about the safety concern that we have? Or still the meeting is going on?
Hello. Hello. Please, somebody join us this meeting because I'm not hearing anything. I've been logging in back and forth. This is about the safety concerns.